Hi, I hope everybody had a good lunch. And when last we met, we have been talking about Bill Wilson. We're in the middle of Bill's story, and we're on the bottom of page 8. But before we continue on with Bill's story, we're going to talk about something that happened that's not accounted for here. And we've been talking about Bill's plunge into his alcoholism, and we've been talking that in the first 8 pages of Bill's story is really about step 1 and Bill's plunge into the abyss of his alcoholism. And Bill has so far in the book been hospitalized twice for his alcoholism, and he has come under the care of Dr. William Duncan Silkworth at the Towns Hospital in New York City. And the very first time that he was hospitalized, he was encouraged, very encouraged, that he could do this on self-will. That somehow, as long as he kept this knowledge about him, that he would stay sober. And, of course, we found out that that did not work. After his second hospitalization, he says, fear sobered me for a bit. So now he's just looking to fear to kind of wake him up. And that didn't work, because that insidious day came where he drank once more, and that was November 11th, 1934. Now, unbeknownst to Bill, there were some things happening that were going to put together the other side of the equation that we talked about on page 7, where Bill learns from Dr. Silkworth the nature of the problem. And the problem is the physical allergy and the twist of the mind. Later in Bill's life, the twist of the mind became the mental obsession. And what is an obsession? An obsession is a thought which pushes aside all thought to the contrary. The mental twist is activated by the buildup of emotions. And as these emotions build and build and build, the brain in a compulsive overeater will demand that we go to the food. Will absolutely demand that we go to the food, because the brain is looking for a way out of this intense pain. It is looking for a way out of this agony that comes about in our life as the result of not eating. And Bill knows the problem, but he has no solution for that problem. And what happens is some things that God is going to bring about. Now, in Rhode Island, there was a family, and this was a very wealthy industrialist family. This family also had a summer home in Manchester, Vermont. Manchester, Vermont is right outside East Dorset, Vermont. And East Dorset, Vermont is the birthplace of Bill Wilson. And their name are the Hazards. And their wayward son, Roland, is a very serious alcoholic. Roland Hazard was a drunk. And he wanted to try to stay sober. He did things like he had himself sequestered on a desert island. Money was no object. Now, they owned a company called Burlington Chemicals, Burlington Mills. And if you've ever walked on carpeting in your life, chances are you've walked on carpeting that was manufactured at Burlington Carpeting Company. And because carpeting is not made with natural fibers, by and large, they also owned a large share of stock in a company called Allied Chemical, which is traded even today. These were extremely wealthy people. Money was no object for Roland. And he had himself sequestered on a Caribbean island. And while he was on the island, he managed to stay sober because he couldn't get his hands on any liquor. The minute he got off the island, of course, what happened was he was drunk within a very short period of time. Roland desperately wanted to give his mother and father the gift of seeing him sober just one more time. And just at that time in the 1930s, in its beginning stages was the art of psychiatry. And the psychiatrist that was the most preeminent one in the world was a man by the name of Sigmund Freud. And Sigmund Freud, he was not taking in any new patients. And Roland tried to employ his first, like, lieutenant, the guy that was closely allied with Freud, and that guy's name was Dr. Adler. And Dr. Adler was not taking in any new patients either. The third most preeminent psychiatrist in the world at that time was a man who lived in Switzerland. And in Switzerland lived Carl Jung, Dr. Carl Jung, J-U-N-G. And Dr. Jung treated Roland between 1933 and 1934. And in 1934, he released Roland to go back home to New York. And Roland, after leaving the care of Dr. Jung, went to the shipyard. And when he went to the shipyard, he was drunk within a very, very short period of time because in the shipyard was a bar. And he was drunk. And he goes back to Dr. Jung. And Dr. Jung says to him, I have misdiagnosed you. You are an alcoholic of the most base variety, and you're going to die. Now, I don't know about you, but if a doctor, and they, I've had death sentences from doctors before. I've had them from the time I was a teenager. But Roland desperately wanted to hang on to something which could save his life. And he begged Dr. Jung, give me something to hang on to so that I might live. And Dr. Jung broke rank with Freud and broke rank with Adler on one subject only. Is it odd or is it God that he got to Jung rather than Freud or Adler? Is it odd or is it God? Well, let's just think it's God, because what Dr. Jung told Roland was that here and there were people who had spiritual experiences that would alter and change them so that maybe you could live. But Dr. Jung did not know how to bring these about. And Roland said, I don't necessarily want to go back to church, but I'll do whatever it takes to live. Now, Roland goes back to New York City. And in its zenith at that time, its absolute zenith at that time, was a group of people that were called the Oxford Group. And the Oxford groupers were not concerned with finding a way to stay sober. The Oxford group were people that were looking to practice first century Christianity to the best of their ability. The founder of the Oxford group was a man who was a Lutheran minister named Frank Buckman. And Frank Buckman believed that Christians had lost their zeal. They had lost their enthusiasm. There's a word, enthusiasm. It comes from two old Greek words, entheos, which means from God. And Frank Buckman went to China on a mission. And while in China, he witnessed people that through their altruism, through their service to other human beings, and through giving witness to other human beings about what God had done for them, and by truly considering other people before themselves, that these people were not only practicing Christianity, but they were doing so enthusiastically and happily. And he said, that is what we've been missing, is that service to other people, that altruism, that concern for the other person before the concern of themselves. One of the people that he was in touch with in New York City was a guy who was an Episcopalian minister. And as an Episcopal minister, Sam Shoemaker also believed that this altruism, this service to other people, was vital for the human being. And Sam Shoemaker was in charge of the mission in New York City called the Cavalry Mission. And the Cavalry Mission in New York, under the leadership of Sam Shoemaker, is where Roland goes to get his spiritual experience. He goes in there, and he meets a guy whose family also has a home in Manchester, Vermont. And he meets a guy named Sebra Graves Jr. And Sebra Graves Jr. and Roland are two drunks who knew each other from Vermont, and they are working the six steps of the Oxford Group movement, and they are managing to stay sober. They are managing to stay sober, and they are doing so happily. Now, they don't know the problem, but they are living in the solution. Now, it's the summer of 1934, and in Albany, New York, we're coming back to Roland and Sebra Graves Jr., I promise you, but let's just go, if we can, through the magic of our imagination, go to Albany, New York. And in Albany, New York, the mayoral elections are in full swing, and Mayor Thatcher is running for re-election. Mayor Thatcher has a son named Edwin Ebby Thatcher, who is a drunk. And Edward Ebby Thatcher is embarrassing his father and possibly costing him the election with his drunken antics. So the Thatchers say to Ebby, go to Manchester, Vermont, and fix up the summer place, and when these elections are over, we will be down. And Edwin Ebby Thatcher goes down to Manchester, Vermont, right outside East Dorset, Vermont, and he is now fixing up the summer place. And there are some pigeons, and they land on the wall after he had painted it, and they were doing what pigeons do. So Ebby takes out a shotgun and starts blasting the pigeons. Now, if you live next door to somebody that was blowing off their shotgun, and you had that experience, you'd probably do what Ebby's neighbors did. They called the cops. Cops come out. They say to Ebby, knock it off. We don't care about your dad. We don't care about anybody. Knock it off. This happens again. You're going to Brattleboro. Brattleboro was the insane asylum in Vermont, and that's what they did with drunks at that time. They put them in Brattleboro because that was their asylum for the insane. A couple of weeks later, Ebby is driving drunk, drives right into a woman's kitchen, right into the house. And he doesn't show the slightest bit of contrition. He hasn't got the slightest inkling of remorse. He says to the woman, not, I'm sorry, oh my God, I'll take care of this. He says to the woman in his drunken state, hey, Toots, how about a cup of coffee? So she calls the cops, out come the cops, and in the summer of 1934, August of 1934, Ebby is about to be brought before the judge in East Dorset, Vermont, which is where they had the courts for the Manchester area and everything. And Ebby is about to be remanded to Brattleboro Insane Asylum. Now, I promised you we would come back to Roland and we would come back to Sebra Graves Jr. As soon as I sneeze, we will. Thank you. Okay.
You all couldn't wait to say that.
Yeah, I know. That's it. So, let's go back to New York, Oxford Group, Roland and Sebra Graves Jr. Roland goes home to Rhode Island to show his parents that he is sober. And they are thrilled. I'll teach you another Yiddish word. They're kvelling. Kvelling is rapture beyond imagination. Kvelling. It's a Yiddish word. You kvell. You see your kid become the president of the United States, like the Jewish mother. She goes to the White House. They're about to inaugurate her daughter to be the first female, the first Jewish president of the United States. But she wanted something else for her daughter. Somebody walks up to her and says, "You've got to be so proud of your daughter. She's the president of the United States." And the mother turns and says, "Yes, but her brother is a doctor." So that's kvelling. This is kvelling. Okay, so Roland goes home to Rhode Island, and the Hazards tell him, take a vacation. Go wherever you want. Do whatever you want. Reward yourself. You've been working so hard at the Oxford Group that we want you to enjoy yourself. So he says to his friend Seber Graves Jr., let's go on a vacation. And Seber Graves Jr. says, man, I would love for you to meet my folks. And they plan a trip to Vermont. That very week, at the end of August in 1934, because if they had gone the week before, I would be dead. If they went the week after, I would be dead. But they went that week. And that just happened to be the week that Ebby is about to go before the judge. Now, the judge's name happens to be Seber Graves Senior. Is it odd or is it God that all these things come into play so that we could be here this morning? And Seber Graves Senior is about to make a ruling in the Ebby Thatcher case in early September of 1934. And Roland and Seber Graves Jr. are petitioning the judge because they knew Ebby. They had done some drinking together, and they wanted to take Ebby with them to the Oxford Group meetings in New York City at the Cavalry Mission. And they said to the judge, can you do this? And the judge said, if it was anybody else but you, my son, and Roland, I wouldn't do it. But since your parents own half the time, he didn't say that. But since it's you, Roland, we will do it. And in September of 1934, Ebby is brought to sign extradition papers. What that simply means is, if he doesn't do what these men say, he is waiving extradition and he will be immediately brought back to Vermont from New York to be sentenced to a commitment in Brattleboro Insane Asylum. He goes into the Oxford Group movement in September of 1934. And from September to October and October to November, he has been sober for 2 months. He has 8 weeks of sobriety. And they say to Ebby, go give testimony. What is testimony, he says? Testimony is telling God, what God has done for you. Does that sound like one of our steps? Yeah, it kind of does. Step, what is it now? 12, yeah, thank you. It sounds sort of like step 12. But as ancient as any religion and any culture can be, these are ancient teachings, these are ancient practices. If you've ever been around Jews on a holiday, this is most of our holiday. They tried to kill us. A couple of us got away. Let's eat. But the bottom line is that in most of our things, it's in our most sacred prayer. And you shall teach this diligently unto your children. That you will teach them of the Exodus. You will teach them of these various things. And this is very common to cultures, that you have these experiences. Now go tell your children. Tell the next generation. Tell others what God has done for you. And Ebby doesn't exactly want to go give testimony. He figures he's going to make a complete baboon of himself. And he says, well, I don't want to give testimony. And they say, no problem. We'll book you back right to Brattleboro from here. And he says, you know what? I think I'll go give some testimony. So he does his Winnie the Pooh. Think. Who can he go give testimony to where he won't die of embarrassment? And he thinks about his old drinking buddy, Bill Wilson. He and Bill had done lots of drinking together, caused quite a ruckus together with their drinking, and Ebby is about to make a call on his old drinking buddy from East Dorset, Vermont, Bill Wilson. And Bill is drinking, he is drunk, and he's about to get a visit from an old friend that he heard had been committed to the insane asylum, but had somehow escaped. And that's... Let's go to the bottom of page 8. And now we're going to see a marriage. Not a marriage between people. We're going to see the marriage of the problem which Bill got from Silkworth and the solution that he's about to get. And we're going to see events here that are going to forever change the world we live in today. They are going to change forever the plight of the addicted. They're going to raise the understanding and raise the possibility that I, like those who have gone on before me, can recover if I just walk in their footsteps. Let's see the bottom of page 8. My musing was interrupted by the telephone. The cheery voice of an old school friend asked if he might come over. He was sober. It was years since I could remember his coming to New York in that condition. I was amazed. Rumor had it that he had been committed for alcoholic insanity. I wondered how he had escaped. Of course he would have dinner, but then I could drink openly with him. Unmindful of his welfare, I thought only of recapturing the spirit of other days. There was that time we had chartered an airplane to complete a jag. His coming was an oasis in this dreary desert of futility, the very thing, an oasis. Drinkers are like that. The door opened and he stood there, fresh-skinned and glowing. There was something about his eyes. He was inexplicably different. What had happened? I pushed a drink across the table. He refused it. Disappointed but curious, I wondered what had gotten into the fellow. He wasn't himself. Come, what's all this about? I queried. He looked straight at me. Simply but smilingly, he said, I've got religion. Oh, so that's it. I was aghast. So that was it. Last summer, an alcoholic crackpot. Now I suspected a little cracked about religion. He had that starry-eyed look. Yeah, the old boy was on fire, all right, but bless his heart, let him rant. Besides, my gin would last longer than his preaching. But he did no ranting. In a matter-of-fact way, he told how two men had appeared in court persuading the judge to suspend his commitment. They had told of a simple religious idea and a practical program of action. That was 2 months ago, and the result was self-evident. It worked. He had come to pass this experience, his experience along to me if I cared to have it. I was shocked but interested. Certainly I was interested. I had to be, for I was hopeless. He talked for hours. Childhood memories rose before me. I could almost hear the sound of the preacher's voice as I sat on still Sundays way over there on the hillside. There was that proffered temperance pledge I never signed. My grandfather's good-natured contempt of some church folk and their doings. His insistence that the spheres really had their music. But his denial of the preacher's right to tell him how he must listen. His fearlessness as he spoke of these things just before he died. These recollections welled up from the past. They made me swallow hard. That wartime day in old Winchester Cathedral came back again. I had always believed in a power, watch your capitals here, in a power greater than myself. I had often pondered these things. I was not an atheist. Few people really are, for that means blind faith in the strange proposition that this universe originated in a cipher. A cipher means nothing, zero, and aimlessly rushes nowhere. My intellectual heroes, the chemists, the astronomers, even the evolutionists suggested vast laws and forces at work. Despite contrary indications, I had little doubt that a mighty purpose and rhythm underlay all. How could there be so much a precise and immutable law and no intelligence? I simply had to believe in a spirit of the universe who knew neither time nor limitation, but that was as far as I had gone. with ministers in the world's religions, I parted right there. When they talked of a God personal to me who was love, superhuman strength, and direction, I became irritated and my mind snapped shut against such a theory. To Christ, I conceded the certainty of a great man not too closely followed by those who claimed him, his moral teaching most excellent. For myself, I had adopted those parts at which seemed convenient and not too difficult. The rest I disregarded. Now, before we read the next paragraph, here's Bill, and he's being presented a solution to a problem that has plagued him from the time he got out of World War I. This is an answer to a problem that he has been hospitalized for twice. This is the solution to a problem that has cost him everything in his life, has cost him his friends, has cost him his livelihood, has dragged him through pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization, and yet he is resisting it. And you see the struggles that he's going through with this God idea. And in the next little paragraph here, we're going to see that he's doing the same things many of us did. There are people in this room, and there are people in any room I could go to in my life that have suffered tremendous amounts of pain and disappointment. There are people in this room that have had injustices done to them. There are people in this room that have had horrible experiences in their life, and they come into OA and we say to those people, embrace God. And some of you have been abandoned, and some of you have been hurt, and some of you have been disappointed. I didn't get a pony either. And some of you, you just can't understand that if there's a God, then how did this happen? How did that monster do those things to me? How did those people treat me like that? How was I abandoned? Didn't anybody notice that I was hurting? Didn't anybody notice that I was crying? Didn't anybody notice that I had pain that seared through me like a hot knife through butter? Where were you, God? I know a little bit about that too. I grew up at the feet of my father. I understand what it's like to look into the face of injustice. I understand what it is like to touch the hands of injustice. I get it. I was 335 pounds as a senior at Mather High School in Chicago. I get it. I understand. I know loneliness. I know pain, and so do you. And there are theologians, and there are philosophers, and poets, and artists. There are playwrights. There are authors who are going to spend today musing about what God is and what God is not. Let them waste their time. There are two things I need to know about God. There is one, and it's not me. There is one, and it's not me. And I have to embrace those characteristics of this power greater than myself, or I'm going to die in the food. And it's very easy to look around at the sunset, at the sunrise over Lake Michigan. It's very easy to see the sun glistening off the buildings of our skyline in Chicago and be awestruck and say, oh, look at what God has done. But if on the way home we start thinking about what we don't have, if on the way home we start thinking about who doesn't love us the way we love them, if on the way home we get a bill or a disappointment, or we're jealous, or we're angry, or we're scared, it seems that faith has a tendency to vanish very quickly. I have to embrace God in all things. I have to see God in all things. Nothing is good or bad, only my thinking makes it so. I do not know what is good, and I do not know what is bad. It is only that. There is no such thing as bad. There are only things my ego does not want to hear. I have been rejected. Boy, have I been. No. I have been rejected by women my whole life. God's rejection is God's protection. How do I know that wasn't the worst thing that could have happened to me? I have no idea. I have no idea. Let's continue. But what I have to do is I have to define a God. I have to do a job description of a God that I am willing to believe in. I cannot take the God of my childhood, the God that was thrust upon me in the synagogue of my childhood, and make a program out of it. It will not work. That God that separated the Red Sea, that God that gave us manna from heaven, that God that made the oil burn for 8 days when it should have burned for 1 day, wouldn't keep me out of the Kit Kat bars for 8 seconds. That's a great God. Good job. Yay! It's not going to keep me out of the ice cream and the Kit Kats for 8 seconds. I need a God that is alive, because I'm alive. And what can living things do that biblical ancient things cannot do? They can grow and adapt. 5 years ago now, I was a married man living in a big house. 5 years ago today, I had a kid and a house and a yard and all that. I don't have any of those things anymore. I'm single. My life has changed. I'm coming back from the housing crisis, and little by little I'm inching my way back income-wise. Things are looking up a little bit here and a little bit there. But I need a God that's going to stay with me through all that, and that's exactly what I have. Choose that God. Choose the God that's going to be there for you, not a punishing God, not a God of scarcity, not a God that's going to let you down. Forget that stuff. Forget it. We don't know. Just move forward with a God that you are willing to believe in. Page 11, the wars which had been fought, the burnings, chicanery that religious dispute had facilitated made me sick. I honestly doubted whether, on balance, the religions of mankind had done any good. Judging from what I had seen in Europe and since, the power of God in human affairs was negligible. The brotherhood of man, a grim jest. If there was a devil, he seemed the boss universal, and he certainly had me. But my friend sat before me, and he made the point-blank declaration that God had done for him what he could not do for himself. His human will had failed. Doctors had pronounced him incurable. Society was about to lock him up. Like myself, he had admitted complete defeat. Then he had, in effect, been raised from the dead, suddenly taken from the scrap heap to a level of life better than the best he had ever known. Had this power originated in him? Obviously it had not. There had been no more power in him than there was in me at that moment, and that was none at all. That floored me. It began to look as though religious people were right after all. Here was something at work in a human heart which had done the impossible. My ideas about miracles were drastically revised right then. Never mind the musty past. Here sat a miracle directly across the kitchen table. He shouted great tidings. So what Ebby did by sitting there sober was he took all argument away from Bill. And what he did for Bill was what we can do for you who are abstinent. And you know I don't like that term, abstinent, who have a relationship with food that's sane rather than insane. I haven't compulsively overeaten for 16 years. And you know why I haven't compulsively overeaten for 16 years? I don't want to. I have no desire to eat compulsively. I am not fighting food. Ebby was doing for Bill what Bill couldn't do for himself. He showed him a living, breathing example of someone who could recover using this method. Took all argument away from him. Never mind the musty past. Forget the splitting of the Red Sea and the manna from heaven. Forget it. It's 2-something in the afternoon in Los Angeles, California on January 24th, 2015. And there's a room that is absolutely packed with compulsive overeaters. And I don't know what you got in your head, and I don't know what you got in your purse, and I don't know what you got in your room, and I don't know what you're planning later, but here's what I can tell you. As I look around, there's not one of you that is compulsively overeating at this minute. And if that isn't a miracle, and if that isn't God, then I don't know what is. Not one of you is eating compulsively at this particular second. It took all argument away from him. And he had to see it. And he did see it. And that's why we're here today. Bottom of 11, very bottom. I saw that my friend was much more than inwardly reorganized. He was on a different footing. His roots grasped new soil. Despite the living example of my friend, there remained in me the vestiges of my old prejudice. The word God still aroused a certain antipathy when the thought was expressed that there might be a God personal to me. This feeling was intensified. I didn't like the idea. I could go for such conceptions as creative intelligence, universal mind, or spirit of nature, but I resisted the thought of a czar of the heavens, however loving his sway might be. I have since talked with scores of men who felt the same way. My friend suggested what then seemed a novel idea. He said, "Why don't you choose your own conception of God?" You know what? I can't argue with my conception of anything. Let me believe the way I want to. Let me play the game according to my rules, and I will never fight that. And that's what that statement opened the door to countless millions and millions of people just like us. Why don't you choose your own conception of God? Let go of a God that doesn't work. And where you see people struggling in 4, and you see people struggling in 9, and you see people struggling in 10, 11, and 12, they are really struggling in 2. The step that they're really struggling with is 2. They don't see the need for the spiritual awakening because no one explained it to them correctly, or they weren't willing to listen, or they didn't want to hear, or they have a conception of God that is out to kick their butt, and the conception of God that they have is not adequate to make a beginning. You have to have a conception of God that you're willing to believe in so you can go ahead and understand that God is with you. That's why 2 comes before 3, before 4, before 5. It's very, very important. Where you see people struggling, often it's in 2. That statement hit me hard. It melted the icy intellectual mountain in whose shadow I had lived and shivered many years. I stood in the sunlight at last. It was only a matter of being willing to believe in a power greater than myself. Nothing more was required of me to make my beginning. And step 3 is a beginning. I saw that growth could start from that point. Upon a foundation of complete willingness, I might build what I saw in my friend. Would I have it? Of course I would. Thus was I convinced God is concerned with us humans when we want him enough. At long last, I saw, I felt, I believed. Scales of pride and prejudice fell from my eyes. A new world came into view. You do not have to wait for page 83 to get promises. He is giving you promises right there. He said, "I saw, I believed." And he said, "A new world came into view." And Bill Wilson is showing you this because this is what he was going through at the time. That Ebby's sobriety, that Ebby sitting there in the kitchen, sober, opened him up to the possibility that this was a solution, that this was something that would work for him and work for us all. Okay, Linda, where am I here? Thank you. Thanks. The bottom of 12, the real significance of my experience in the cathedral burst upon me. Am I stopping? Okay. Burst upon me. For a brief moment, I had needed and wanted God. There had been a humble willingness to have him with me, and he came. But soon the sense of his presence had been blotted out by worldly clamors, mostly those within myself. So it had been ever since, how blind I had been. In other words, once again, Bill wants this spirituality, but he sees I don't have any money, my relationship at home sucks. So he says, well, how could there be a God? There's nothing in the book that says now your life gets perfect. No matter how evolved my recovery gets, I will never rise above the level of a human being. And no matter how evolved my recovery gets, there are going to be very, very human things that are happening in my life. I'm going to have crushes on girls and they're not going to like me back. I'm going to want to make X amount of dollars and I'm going to make something less. I'm going to, whatever that may be in your life, there is nothing in here that says now you will rise above humanness and things will be perfect for you. Doesn't happen like that. At the hospital, page 13. I was separated from alcohol for the last time. Treatment seemed wise, for I showed signs of delirium tremens. Delirium tremens is the shaking that the alcoholics do. Now, let's stay with this now, and let's walk through this. There I humbly offered myself to God. Oh, wait a minute. This is his third of the accounted for hospitalizations in the big book. Now he's been to some Oxford group meetings during November and December. Bill goes back into the hospital on the 13th of December, 1934. And on the 14th of December, which is his first full day of hospitalization, after going to some Oxford group meetings, he says, there I humbly offered myself to God as I then understood him to do with me as he would. I placed myself unreservedly under his care and direction. I admitted for the first time of myself I was nothing, that without him I was lost. Those are steps 1, 2, and 3. I ruthlessly faced my sins, and ruthlessly faced my sins means 4, 6, and 7. And became willing to have my newfound friend take them away. That's 6 and 7. Sorry, 4, and then the next part is 6 and 7. Take them away, root and branch. I have not had a drink since. So he's worked steps 1, 2, 3, 4, 6, and 7 so far. My schoolmate visited me. That was Ebby. I fully acquainted him with my problems and deficiencies, step 5. We made a list of people I had hurt or toward whom I felt resentment. I expressed my entire willingness to approach these individuals, admitting my wrong. Steps 8 and 9. Never was I to be critical of them. I was to write all such matters to the utmost of my ability. Step 10. I was to test my thinking by the new God consciousness within. Common sense would thus become uncommon sense. I was to sit quietly when in doubt, asking only for direction and strength to meet my problems as he would have me. Never was I to pray for myself, except as my request bore on my usefulness to others. Then only might I expect to receive, but that would be in great measure. That's step 11. Now, he's done the first 11 steps of what we know today to be the program. There's one step he has not worked. My friend promised when these things were done, I would enter upon a new relationship with my Creator, that I would have the elements of a way of living which answered all my problems. There's nothing in my life that isn't made better by program. Belief in the power of God, plus enough willingness, honesty, and humility to establish and maintain the new order of things, were the essential requirements. Simple but not easy, a price had to be paid. It meant destruction of self-centeredness. I must turn in all things to the Father of Light who presides over us all. These were revolutionary and drastic proposals, but the moment I fully accepted them, the effect was electric. There was a sense of victory, followed by such a peace and serenity as I had never known. There was utter confidence. I felt lifted up as though the great clean wind of a mountaintop blew through and through. God comes to most men gradually, but his impact on me was sudden and profound. For a moment I was alarmed and called my friend the doctor to ask if I were still sane. He listened in wonder as I talked. Finally, he shook his head saying, something has happened to you I don't understand, but you had better hang on to it. Anything is better than the way you were. The good doctor now sees many men who've had such experiences. He knows they are real. Now, Bill was born as a selfish son of a bitch. He's an alcoholic. He can only think of himself. And as he's laying in that hospital, and he's had his spiritual experience, he always said that the white light came and filled the room. The white light came in the room, and he never found it necessary to drink again. Let's see where he goes with that since he's had his experience. While I lay in the hospital, the thought came that there were thousands of hopeless alcoholics who might be glad to have what had been so freely given me. Perhaps I could help some of them. They, in turn, might work with others. My friend had emphasized the absolute necessity of demonstrating these principles in all my affairs. So there's your second part of step 12. Particularly was it imperative to work with others as he had worked with me. Faith without works was dead. Now, faith without works is dead is going to be repeated four times, I believe, in the big book. It is Ann Smith's favorite Bible verse. Ann was married to Dr. Bob. Because what they wanted to establish here is that this is not a program for people who need it. It is not a program for people who want it. It is a program for people who do it. Thank you, Allie, and all of you. But the bottom line is, this is a program for people who do it. This is an action program. This is not anything short of action. There's no chapter into thinking, and there's no chapter into praying. There's a chapter into action. You can think and you can pray. Those are good things. I pray every day and think every day. But I have to act. Okay. Linda. Oh, and how appalling, right? How appalling, thanks. How appallingly true for the alcoholic. For if an alcoholic failed to perfect and enlarge his spiritual life through work and self-sacrifice for others, he could not survive the certain trials and low spots ahead. If he did not work, he would surely drink again, and if he drank, he would surely die. Then faith would be dead indeed. With us, it is just like that. And how do we perfect and enlarge our spiritual life? Through 10, 11, and 12 every single day. The 10th step is not a step that you work in the morning and at night. The 10th step is a step you work all the time. I do 10-step calls all the time. 11 is the step that's done in the morning and at night. We'll get into that later this afternoon. 10 we'll do tomorrow. Sorry, 10 we'll do tomorrow. My wife and I abandoned ourselves with enthusiasm to the idea of helping other alcoholics to a solution of their problems. It was fortunate, for my old business associates remained skeptical for a year and a half, during which I found little work. I was not too well at the time and was plagued by waves of self-pity and resentment. This sometimes nearly drove me back to drink, but I soon found that when all other measures failed, work with another alcoholic would save the day. Make note of that in your brain. That when all other measures fail, work with another alcoholic will save the day. Many times I have gone to my old hospital in despair. On talking to a man there, I would be amazingly lifted up and set on my feet. It is a design for living that works in rough going. We commenced to make many fast friends, and a fellowship has grown up among us of which it is a wonderful thing to feel a part. The joy of living we really have, even under pressure and difficulty. I have seen hundreds of families set their feet in the path that really goes somewhere, have seen the most impossible domestic situations righted, feuds and bitternesses of all sorts wiped out. I have seen men come out of asylums and resume a vital place in the lives of their families and communities. Business and professional men have regained their standing. There is scarcely any form of trouble and misery which has not been overcome among us. In one western city, Akron, Ohio, and its environs, there are 1,000 of us in our families. We meet frequently so that newcomers may find the fellowship they seek. At these informal gatherings, one may often see from 50 to 200 persons. We are growing in numbers and power. An alcoholic in his cups is an unlovely creature. Our struggles with them are variously strenuous, comic, and tragic. One poor chap committed suicide in my home. He could not or would not see our way of life. There is, however, a vast amount of fun about it all. I suppose some would be shocked at our seemingly worldliness and levity. But just underneath there is deadly earnestness. Faith has to work 24 hours a day in and through us, or we perish. Most of us feel we need look no further for utopia. We have it right with us right here and now. Each day, my friend's simple talk in our kitchen multiplies itself in a widening circle of peace on earth, goodwill toward men. Bill Wilson, co-founder of AA, died January 24th, 1971. Now, I hope before we're going to take a little break here. My kidneys and gallbladder are demanding it. But what I'm going to tell you is I hope, as God is my judge, that what I've done or what we've done here together is make this story come alive. Make the story more about what you're going through with step one and what you may be struggling with in step two. Step two is a gotcha step. Too much of the time, it'll cut you down. Let's come back in 10 minutes. Okay. We've been talking about the problem. Yes, there is. But we're going to go right to chapter 5. Oh, yeah. Sure. I'm supposed to read this to you when we're done. I'll read it now and then I'll read it again. Please announce at end. We need your badge holders. If you are leaving, please drop them off at the front desk. Thanks. If you're leaving, drop your badge things off at the desk. Okay. So we've been talking about the problem. We've been talking about the solution. There's a lot of information that we're not going to be able to get to in chapters 2, 3, and 4, more than I could even imagine is in there. But we're going to go to chapter 5, and we're going to look at how it works. And we're going to look at the two most misunderstood steps. We're going to look at the most misunderstood steps of 3 and 4. No steps are as misunderstood as 3 and 4. No steps are as underutilized as 2 and 10. No steps are as misunderstood as 3 and 4. When the first four chapters were written, Bill knew that it was time for him to write chapter 5. And he did so with much concern for how this would be accepted. He knew that it was time for him to lay out the plan of action which would bring a spiritual awakening about as a result of these steps. Bill Wilson had good close contact with Sam Shoemaker. Sam Shoemaker, in many ways, was Bill's mentor, Bill's sponsor. Sam Shoemaker believed that there were four impediments to God. An impediment is something which impedes progress or slows or stops progress. An impediment slows or stops progress. And he believed that the four impediments to God are a resentment that you will not let go of, an amends that you will not make, a vicarious pleasure that you will not let go of. And when I say a vicarious pleasure, I'm not talking about playing with your dog or enjoying your children or reading. It's not what we're talking about. We're talking about lying and getting away with it. We're talking about stealing and getting away with it. We're talking about that kind of thing, gossiping and getting away with it. That's the kind of vicarious pleasure that we're talking about. And last but not least, a secret that you will not tell. We do not do our steps to give you busy work. We're not here to assign you homework. The four impediments to God that Sam Shoemaker taught Bill Wilson were a resentment that you will not let go of, an amends, a restitution that you will not make, a vicarious pleasure that you will not let go of, and a secret that you will not tell. Now, does that mean I have to tell everybody my PIN number? No. It means I have to tell somebody what's bothering me. I have to tell somebody about who I'm mad at. I have to tell somebody about my fears, about my jealousies, about... The fourth one, the first one is a resentment that you will not let go of. The second one is a restitution that you will not make. Third one is a vicarious thrill that you will not let go of. And the fourth one is a secret that you will not tell. Those are the four impediments to God. Now, why is it so important to get to God? What does God have to do with this? Well, we've only been talking about that since 9 o'clock this morning. If I am a compulsive overeater of the hopeless variety, only a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps is going to dispel my emotions. They're going to stop my emotions from building to the level where I will not find it necessary to eat. And how they do that is they quiet my emotions before my emotions build, by giving me the happiness of the spiritual awakening.
Can you repeat that, please?
I hope so. Okay, if my emotions are building to the level where they wake up the mental twist, I am going to eat because that's what people like me do. But if I'm having a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps, my emotions will not build to the level where my emotions find it necessary to drive me irresistibly into the food, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion again. What I'm doing when I work these steps is I'm trading the momentary pleasure of the food for the lifetime of happiness promised in the spiritual awakening as a result of the steps. I am allowing God to do for me slowly what the food will do for me instantly with none of the devastating side effects. And as I do these things, as I work these steps, I get right with God, I get right with myself, and I get right with my fellow human being. Okay? Write your questions down because we'll take them at the end. Because if I stop now, they're going to be at that door going, Fatso, it's time for you to stop. And I don't want them at the door going, Chubby, let's move it along. Okay. But we're not leaving for dinner tonight. I'm staying for the dinner that's here, so that'll ease my schedule quite a bit. All this running around has got me all tired out. Okay. How it works. Bill was rather nocturnal at this time in his life, and he was up very, very late at night, and the first four chapters were written, and he looked at this, and he had his pencil and his pad. And he said it was almost as if the pencil took on a life of its own. And he said within about a half hour, 30 minutes, one of the greatest pieces of spiritual literature that the world has ever seen was written. Chapter 5, How It Works. And he showed it to an alcoholic who came by the house about 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. The guy knew that Bill was still up. And he came in there and he says, look at what I've done. And this guy was an old drunk. And he says, what in the world is this? He says, up until now, we've had a 6-step program. Now you want to change it to a 12-step program. And the fight was on. And boy, the fight was on. And they fought Bill tooth and nail. And no chapter had more compromises in it than chapter 5. Chapter 5 has the most compromises in it. And Bill said, okay, I'm not going to fight with you anymore. Either I'm going to write this or you're going to write this. And they said, well, we want you to write the book, but it's our book, Bill. It's not your book. And Bill was cunning, baffling, and powerful too. And he knew how to fight for what he believed in. Could we get somebody to close that door? Not that I'm not enjoying the air, but it is really kind of, we're hearing like plates and we're hearing like yelling and stuff like that. So thank you very much. Thank you. How It Works, page 58. And let's listen to the language of what he's conveying here. how it works. Rarely have we seen a person fail who has thoroughly followed our path. Now, there's a booby mindset around that says what he really wanted to write was never have we seen a person, and that's not true. That's absolutely not true. Bill understood and God understood the alcoholic mind. And if you put never, then some drunk out in God knows where is going to pick up a bottle of whiskey and say, oh yeah, well here's bottoms up. And he's going to get drunk. So he deliberately put in rarely because he didn't want to wave the red flag in front of some alcoholic. Those who do not recover are people who cannot or will not completely give themselves to this simple program. Usually men and women who are constitutionally incapable of being honest with themselves. What is it that they're supposed to be honest with themselves about? They are supposed to be honest with themselves that they cannot on their own control the amount they eat once they've started because of the allergy, and they cannot keep from eating now that they want to because of the mental twist. That's what you're being asked to be honest about. Okay, so let's see how many times this theme, because we're going to see the tapestry of the book coming alive, how many times the same things are being repeated and repeated and repeated. Okay, there are such unfortunates. They are not at fault. They seem to have been born that way. They are naturally incapable of grasping and developing a manner of living which demands rigorous honesty. There it is again. Their chances are less than average. There are those, too, who suffer from grave emotional and mental disorders, but many of them do recover if they have the capacity to be honest. So three times in the same paragraph, we have that concept of honesty. And what we're being asked to be honest about is, can you control the amount you eat once you've started? And if you have the allergy, you cannot. And can you keep from eating now that you want to? And if you have the mental twist, you cannot. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened, and what we are like now. Here's what I refer to as step zero. If you've decided you want what we have and are willing to go to any length to get it, then you are ready to take certain steps. So I ask people that I sponsor when we get to this part, if you decided you want what we have, what is it we seem to have? And we talked about that this morning. If you're new, this is what we have. And you know, you can look at it and say, well, you guys aren't eating. Well, that's part of it, yeah. But the real issue is we're not eating and we are doing so happily. We are doing so happily. I haven't compulsively overeaten in 16 years. And the reason I don't compulsively overeat is I don't want to. I don't want to compulsively overeat. I feel great. I feel great. And the reason that I feel great is I work my steps. I better, because my sponsor is running around the building. Okay. And you're willing to go to any length to get it. Am I willing to go to any length to get it? Today, I absolutely am. I don't know about tomorrow, but for today, I'm willing to do whatever it takes so that I can recover from this illness. Then you are ready to take certain steps. At some of these we balked. We thought we could find an easier, softer way, but we could not. With all the earnestness at our command, we beg of you to be fearless and thorough from the very start. Some of us have tried to hold on to our old ideas, and the result was nil until we let go. Absolutely. Listen to the language. The result was nil until we let go. Absolutely. This is very absolute language. There's no ambiguity here. There's no middle ground here. You're either in recovery or you're in the illness, and there is no middle ground. Recovery is a vending machine. I bet you didn't think I'd say that today, did you? Unless you're from Scottsdale. Recovery is a vending machine. And if the product costs $1 and you put in 99 cents, what are you going to get out? Nothing. You'll be lucky if you get your 99 cents back. You're going to get back nothing. You're either in or you're out. Everything I do today, I am either walking toward God or I am walking toward the food. And there is no middle ground. the way I address people, the way I talk to people in the hall. Some of you stop me and I got to go to the bathroom, and some of you stop me and my knee hurts or my hip hurts. Am I willing to take that second to be kind to somebody who has approached me in the hallway to tell me how much they enjoy this, or tell me that I'm ugly, or tell me I'm stupid? Whatever it is they're stopping me to tell me, it is my job to treat them as God would treat them, and to treat them as I want to be treated. That's what I need to do today. Tomorrow it'll be a different thing. Tomorrow I have to go to the airport. I have to go through security. I have to get on an airplane. I have to do whatever I have to do. And I'll land in Phoenix something around 6 o'clock, whatever it is. I don't know what time. 4 o'clock, like 5 o'clock, 6 o'clock, whatever it is. And then I have to go get my car. So these are very human things, very, very human things. And I have to treat people as I would want to be treated. Linda? Oh, remember, thanks. Remember that we deal with alcohol, cunning, baffling, powerful. Without help, it is too much for us. But there is one, watch your capitals here, who has all power. That one is God. May you find him now. Exclamation point. May you find him now. Exclamation point. Half measures availed us nothing. There's the same thing again. Same theme of till we let go. Absolutely. Half measures availed us nothing. We stood at the turning point. We asked his protection and care with complete abandon. Let's go to page 263 in the fourth edition. Let's see where these steps come from. Let's see where it is. 263. Okay. This was the six-step program that they were working in the Oxford Group movement at the time that they formulated the 12 steps. Here she is. Did you bring enough coffee for everyone? Oh, well, I don't know. Okay. Here was the six-step program as they were working it at that time. Number one, complete deflation. Number two, dependence and guidance from a higher power. Number three, moral inventory. Number four, confession. Number five, restitution. And number six, continued work with other alcoholics. And these were taken from the Oxford Group tenants, and this was the six-step recovery program that they were working at the time. And this is very important because this is the source of much controversy. And Bill saw these alcoholics slipping through these six steps, and he saw that they were getting by. And he wanted to close down those loopholes. He never set out to write 12 steps. You can go back to page 60. He never set out to write 12 steps, but that is exactly what did happen, is he ended up writing 12 steps. We won't read our 12 steps for the sake of time because there's no purpose to it. You can read them on your own, obviously. Okay. What many of us exclaimed, I'm getting tired here. Okay, what an order. I can't go through with it. Do not be discouraged. No one among us has been able to maintain anything like perfect adherence to these principles. We are not saints. The point is that we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. What are the principles? The principles are the steps. Thank you. Very good. Very, very good. You know, you'll see the principle of one is this and the principle. No. He just didn't want to use the same word over and over and over and over again. So he uses principles and steps and laws and rules and things interchangeably. We are not saints. The point is we are willing to grow along spiritual lines. The principles we have set down are guides to progress. We claim spiritual progress rather than spiritual perfection. Our description of the alcoholic, that's chapters, the doctor's opinion, chapter 1, 2, and 3. The chapter to the agnostic, chapter 4. And our personal adventures, before and after, made clear three pertinent ideas. Now, most of the time that this is read in a meeting, you're either playing with your cell phone or parking your car in the parking lot, or you're getting out your Starbucks while you haven't brought enough for everybody. Nope. I'm not pointing fingers at anybody. or you're doing anything but paying attention. But I want you to pay attention because there's a wealth of knowledge right here in these ABCs. A, that we were alcoholic and could not manage our own life. What does that mean, we were alcoholic? It means we have an allergy of the body and a twist of the mind. Now, the reason that I say that so many times during my big book studies is this, because your ego wants you to forget that very quickly. There are people that will walk out of here from all the talking we do in here, and they will forget that, and they will go back on their diets once they leave this room. Diets don't work. They don't work because as my emotions build up, they will knock on the door of the mental twist. The mental twist will demand the food. Anytime the emotional meets the intelligent, the emotional will beat the intelligent, and I will eat the food. What happens when I eat the food? I will trigger the physical allergy. Thank you, Allie. And the bottom line is, I see everybody answers, but I've got to, you know, I've got to specify you, right? Okay. Now, see, I'm partial to my Scottsdalians over here, even though they're former Scottsdalians. Okay. Is that proper, Scottsdalians? I think so, too. We're the guys that bake in the summer and come to San Diego and drop our cash. Okay. To get out of the heat. Okay. It will demand the food and will eat the food, thereby setting the terrible cycle in motion. And could not manage our own lives. If I can't eat because of the allergy, I can't keep from eating because of the twist of the mind, my life's unmanageable at that point. That probably no human power could have relieved our alcoholism. Now, I'm going to mention some names here that are going to illustrate beautifully what I'm talking about. Karen Carpenter, President Taft, Mama Cass, Jackie Gleason, Jim Gandolfini, John Candy, Chris Farley. All of these people and more who had all the money, who had all the fame, who had all the externals that you would die for. And they died in our illness. President Taft couldn't get elected dog catcher today. He was so obese that he had to have his bathtub from Ohio sent into the White House because he couldn't fit in the bathtub that they had in there. If that got out today, he couldn't be elected dog catcher. Karen Carpenter, Mama Cass Elliott, they had voices like angels. Jackie Gleason, brilliant comedian. If you don't know who these people are, Google them. Chris Farley, John Candy, all these various people and more than them are dead, and they had all the externals. Mama Cass Elliott died in London, shoving a sandwich in her mouth prior to a performance. She couldn't get it in there fast enough, and she died. The Mamas and the Papas were one of the best groups of the 60s, and she died because of our illness. Look at these people in their lives. They had everything that you could ever want, and this illness didn't care. This illness is mind over matter. It doesn't mind killing you, and you don't matter. Don't challenge this illness. Don't raise this illness's ire. Don't piss this illness off with your dieting. This illness will take you out, and it'll ruin the lives of you and anyone close to you. And it couldn't care less who the heck you are. Mind over matter. This illness doesn't mind killing you, and you don't matter. Your children, as innocent as they may be, your parents, your relatives, your friends, your spouses, they will go down. When this illness hits, it hits hard. That God could and would if he were sought. Come on, Give God a break here. Give God a chance in your life by defining Him as a loving spirit of the universe that's going to help you. There's nothing in the book that says now life gets perfect. There's nothing in the book that says now you get the girl, now you get the guy, now you get the car or the horse or the pony or the whatever it is you want. There's nothing in here that says that's what happens. But there are promises all through the book that say, come on, walk with us who are recovered. Walk with us and do these things and you will have a life beyond your wildest dreams. You can recover if you do the work that God could and would if He were sought. And how do you seek God? This is going to be the only book that's going to tell you how to do that. You seek Him by working these steps. You seek Him by working the steps. I came here seeking God. I couldn't find Him. I came here seeking myself. I couldn't find me. I sought my fellow human being and I found all three. I came here and I found all three in seeking my fellow human being. Page 60, being convinced we were at step three, which is that we decided to turn our will and our life over to God as we understood Him. Just what do we mean by that and just what do we do? And you hear this, three and four are the most misunderstood steps. What is your life and what is your will? So few people know. Your life is your action and your will is your decision-making thinking. What you're turning over in 4 through 12, you don't turn anything over to God in 3. You turn it over to Him in 4 through 12. My life is my actions, and my will is my thinking. Okay? Let's take a look at what we have here. And what we're going to do here is we're going to define the first character defect. And if I'm your sponsor, and there are people in the room that I either have sponsored or am currently sponsoring, and you call me for a 10-step call, the very first character defect we're going to talk about, and I could let you guys answer it, but it's going to be this one, selfishness. In other words, the script. What is the selfishness? It is that script. And let's go to this chair. Let's go to this paragraph. And the very first character defect, and I see a couple of you laughing at me, but I see the first character defect. Stop. The first character defect is selfishness, and we're going to define that now. The first requirement, page 60, is that we be convinced that any life run on self-will can hardly be a success. On that basis, we are almost always in collision with something or somebody, even though our motives are good. Boy, the road to hell is paved with good intentions, isn't it? Most people try to live by self-propulsion. Each person is like an actor who wants to run the whole show, is forever trying to arrange the lights, the ballet, the scenery, and the rest of the players in his own way. If his arrangements would only stay put, if only people would do as he wished, the show would be great. Everybody, including himself, would be pleased. Life would be wonderful. In trying to make these arrangements, our actor may sometimes be quite virtuous. He may be kind, considerate, patient, generous, even modest and self-sacrificing. On the other hand, he may be mean, egotistical, selfish, and dishonest. But as with most humans, he is more likely to have varied traits. This is the definition of selfishness as it manifests in our life. This discomfort we have with anyone or anything that does not stick to our script. And if the world isn't going to stick to our script, then we become agitated. And that agitation raises our emotional level. The emotional level knocks on the door of the mental twist and says, we're not comfortable down here. The mental twist says, send in the Kit Kat bars. And then we eat the Kit Kat bars, trigger the allergy, pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful, with a firm resolution not to eat that way again. And we will repeat that cycle over and over again, the mind telling us that the food makes perfect sense and the body ensuring that it does not. Right, very good. You were right there, word for word. Okay, very good. Okay, Now we're going to define we're going to define self-seeking. Uh-oh, my placeholder is leaving. I'm screwed. Okay. We're going to define self-seeking. See, I get slap happy later in the day. I get a little nuts. What usually happens, the show doesn't come off very well. He begins to think life doesn't treat him right. He decides to exert himself even more. He becomes on the next occasion still more demanding or gracious, as the case may be. Still, the play does not suit him. Admitting he may be somewhat at fault, he is sure that other people are more to blame. There's one of the understatements of the year. He becomes angry, indignant, self-pitying. What is his basic trouble? Is he not really a self-seeker even when trying to be kind? Is he not a victim of the delusion that he can wrest satisfaction and happiness out of this world if he only manages well? Is it not evident to all the rest of the players that these are the things he wants? And do not his actions make each of them wish to retaliate, snatching all they can get out of the show? Is he not even in his best moments a producer of confusion rather than harmony? That's, we've defined self-seeking. And as we try to self-seek, these are actions we take or inactions we take to try to get our way. I'll give you the cold shoulder, or I'll yell at you, or I'll do whatever I need to do. But one way or the other, I'm going to try to do what I need to do to get you to give me what it is I want. Our actor, bottom of 61, our actor is self-centered, egocentric, as people like to call it nowadays. He is like the retired businessman who lolls in the Florida sunshine in the winter, complaining of the sad state of the nation, the minister who sighs over the sins of the 20th century, politicians and reformers who are sure all would be utopia if the rest of the world would only behave, the outlaw safecracker who thinks society has wronged him, and the alcoholic who has lost all and is locked up. Whatever our protestations, are not most of us concerned with ourselves, our resentments, or our self-pity? Selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles, driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. We step on the toes of our fellows, and they retaliate. That's the key. Sometimes they hurt us seemingly without provocation, but we invariably find that at some time in the past, we have made decisions based on self, which later placed us in a position to be hurt. Our troubles, we think, are basically of our own making. They arise out of ourselves, and the alcoholic is an extreme example of self-will run riot, though he usually doesn't think so. Above everything, there's another understatement. Above everything, we alcoholics must be rid of this selfishness. We must, or it kills us. How does the selfishness kill us? It keeps driving the emotional level up to a level of discomfort. Once that emotional level becomes so uncomfortable, we will then wake up the mental twist, and the mental twist will say, I've got this. I've got this. Don't worry. Send in the M&Ms with peanuts. And the intelligence says, no. And the emotional says, yes. And the intelligence says, no. But as we've learned today, any time the emotional hits up against the intelligent, the emotional will win 100% of the time. And so, and what is the point of M&Ms without the peanuts? Somebody maybe come, maybe explain this to me. What is the point? This is obviously, and what is the point of a Mounds bar? If you can get for the same amount of money, the coconut with the almond, or just the coconut, what is the point of these things? I don't understand that. I don't get it. Now, I was actually in the store the other day, and I watched somebody buy a regular size Kit Kat, and the king size were sitting right there. What is the point of the regular? I don't get this. I don't understand. These are obviously people that need help. They need help. There is something very wrong here with these people. My God in heaven. Okay. I'm glad Ellie has volunteered to get me more water when this is done. So that's good. Okay. Okay. This is the how and the why of it, right? Is that where I am? First of all, we had to quit playing God. It didn't work. Next, we decided that hereafter in this game, in this drama of life, God was going to be our director. He is the principal. We are his agents. He is the father. We are his children. Most good ideas are simple. And this concept was the keystone of the new and triumphant arch through which we passed to freedom. Now we're going to read the third step, promises. When we sincerely took such a position, all sorts of remarkable things happened. We had a new employer. Being all-powerful, he provided what we needed if we kept close to him and performed his work well. Established on such a footing, we became less and less interested in ourselves, our little plans and designs. More and more, we became interested in seeing what we could contribute to life. As we felt new power flow in, as we enjoyed peace of mind, as we discovered we could face life successfully, we became conscious of his presence. Watch your capitals. We begun to lose our fear of today, tomorrow, or the hereafter. We were reborn. Now, this reborn thing, you don't have to be a born-again Christian. You don't have to be a born-again Jew. You don't have to be a born-again Catholic or anything. But being reborn is something that I have had in my life. The similarity that I have to the little boy born on the 24th of May, 1954, at Mount Sinai Hospital in Chicago, any similarity of just name and parents is totally coincidental. I am not the person that I was. I have been transformed. I have been reborn. I have been reorganized in every way that a human being can be. In my other life, I was an eating, using, lying machine. I wanted to spend the money as long as you made it. I would lie when the truth would have served me better. I lied when the truth actually would have been beneficial, more beneficial to me. I wrote bad checks. I didn't pay my taxes. I hurt a lot of people. And at the very base level, I knew in my mind that I was doing it, and I did it anyway. And somehow, some way, I thought that maybe somehow somebody would come and rescue me. And they did. But that was God. It wasn't a person. It was many people, because often when God can't come, he sends people. He sends very special messengers, like you today being here. Because I'd hate like the Dickens to be sitting here doing the big book study with just me and the water cooler. That would suck. Now, we're going to talk for just a minute before we do the third step prayer about where does anger come from? Where does fear come from? They come from very specific places. Fear and anger do not just flitter around and land on somebody like mosquitoes. Fear and anger come from specific places of the brain, of the mind. And God gave us three basic instincts of life. Thank you, Allison. And the three basic instincts of life are God-given. They are hardwired into us by a loving God. And when we feel a threat, either to our ambitions for the future in these instincts, or we feel a threat that somebody is going to take away what we already have in these areas, we become angry and we become scared and we become emotional to the point where we will put the food in our mouth. Let's go over the first of the instincts which are given to us by God. The first of the instinct is the social instinct. The social instinct is hardwired into us by God, because God knew that human beings could work better together than they can individually. And he knew that as individuals, we could not do the work of living life as efficiently. As far back as Peking Man, Cro-Magnon Man, as far back as the Hittites and the Sumerians, as far back as Heidelberg Man, all the cavemen, the archaeological digs have revealed that these ancients worked and lived together in groups because they could hunt more efficiently, they could trap more efficiently, they could defend themselves against animals and other predators and humans more efficiently in groups than they could by themselves. So if I am part of the group and I get a sense that you are trying to oust me from the group, that's going to affect my social instinct. You're upsetting what I already have in the area of social instinct. Now let's take, for example, that I am part of the group here in this room, and I would like to become part of the group in the next room. And I want to leave the group. Thank you, Roy. And I want to go and be part of the group that's next door. That is something that my ambitions for the future, if you are the one that is, thank you, Allison, that is what we're going to deal with there. Those are my ambitions for the future in this area. So if I perceive that Tom over here, or I perceive that Stephanie over here is the one that is preventing me from getting accepted in that group, they are interfering with my ambitions, and I'm going to fear them, and I'm going to resent them. I'm going to strike out at them through gossip, through whatever, and I'm going to strike out at them and cause as much pain and suffering as I can for them. They, in turn, will retaliate against me, creating pain and suffering for me. And when they do so, they are going to raise my emotional level to the point where my brain will become uncomfortable with it, and my brain, the mental twist, will say, eat the food. And then my intelligence will say, no way. And my emotional will say, eat the food. And my intelligence will say, no way. And what happens when the emotional meets the intelligent? The emotional will win every single time. Every single time. So, that's the social instinct. First we have what we hold now, and then it's our ambitions for the future. Now there's another part of the social instinct, and that part is self-esteem. I want to feel good about myself. Now I don't know how else to explain this, so you're going to have to stay with me on this one. What I think of me is not really what I think of me. Stay with me. What I think of me is what I think you think of me. And if you think I'm a pretty good person, you like me, you seem to get along with me, I'm going to think well of me. If you think I'm a jerk, if you think I'm dumb and ugly, if you think these things, I'm not going to think very well of me. And as these things manifest, I want to think well of me, and so I'm going to create pain and suffering for you. When I do so, you're going to retaliate, creating pain and suffering for me. And that is going to raise my emotional level. It's going to knock on the door of the mental twist. The mental twist is going to say, eat the food, and the terrible cycle will be put in motion again. The second of the instincts, the second of three instincts, is the security instinct. And the security instinct is an instinct that goes all the way back to the Old Testament, where we are told about the 7 years of good times and the 7 years of famine. And we are taught through that parable to put something aside for a rainy day. The security instinct is what drives us to provide food, and shelter, and clothing for our loved ones. We wouldn't do the work necessary. Or if we got $10, we would spend all $10. I don't know about anybody else, and I am all for living my life one day at a time. However, I sure hope I'm not the only one in the room that has a life insurance policy. I hope I'm not the only one in the room that has a savings account. I hope I'm not the only one in the room that sets a little wee bit aside for a rainy day. And we are hardwired to do those things by a loving God through the security instinct. Now, so the first part of the security instinct is pocketbook, money, food, shelter, clothing, whatever that may be, and in different societies and at different times, it can be different things. In one culture, you need X amount of money. In one other culture, you may need X amount of coconuts or X amount of fish or X amount of cattle or whatever that may be. That is what we're dealing with here, the security instinct. Okay, The next part of the security instinct is emotional security. We all have a desire to feel good emotionally. So anything that upsets my emotional security or anything that upsets my ambitions for the future in this emotional security is going to be a factor that is going to raise the emotional level. And when that is done, what will invariably happen is I will trigger the mental twist, and as I do so, it will cause me to eat. It will drive me into the food irresistibly. Okay, the last of the security instincts is personal security. If you perceive danger, you perceive that someone is going to harm you, you will avoid that person, that fear, what we call the uh-oh voice. That uh-oh voice is not to be ignored. If you ignore your uh-oh voice, you're going to be in trouble. If you walk in on a situation and your uh-oh voice is going, you need to listen to that. You don't need to shut your uh-oh voice off. You need to listen to that because your uh-oh voice is good direction. That's usually God. Now, the third of the instincts is the sex instinct. And anything, again, that upsets what I currently have or my ambitions for the future in the sex instinct is going to raise my emotional level to the point where I will eat the food. Now, let's just say, for example, that me and Susie Schmo are married, or me and Susie Schmo are going steady. And Susie Schmo and I are going steady, but I want to go steady with Elizabeth Smith. And I want to leave Susie Schmo. But Elizabeth Smith represents my ambitions for the future. And anything or anybody that upsets my ambitions for the future in this area, I'm going to resent them, I'm going to fear them, and I'm going to, in so doing, cause pain and suffering for them as best I can. They, in turn, will cause it for me, raise my emotional level, it'll knock on the door of the mental twist, and it will drive me into the food. Now, we see these three basic instincts of life. They're hardwired into us by God. They're not to be despised and loathed. They're to be embraced and welcomed. They are important for our growth. If we didn't have a sex instinct, within about 125 years from today, the human race as we know it would be done. It would be done. There wouldn't be one human being left on the face of the earth. And so we have a situation where these things are important. Okay, this is where anger comes from. This is where fear comes from. It doesn't just flitter in and flitter out. It comes from a specific place. Page 63. Many of us said to our Maker as we understood Him, God, if you're really going to do your fourth step, why don't you say this prayer with me and we don't have to say it alone. If you're going to do the work, say it with me. God, I'm on page 63, third step. To build with me and to do with me as Thou wilt. Relieve me of the bondage of self that I may better do Thy will. Take away my difficulties that victory over them may bear witness to those by help of Thy power, Thy love, and way of life. May I do Thy will always. We thought well before taking this step, making sure we were ready, that we could at last abandon ourselves utterly to Him. We found it very desirable to take this spiritual step with an understanding person, such as our wife, best friend, or spiritual advisor. But it is better to meet God alone than with one who might misunderstand. The wording was, of course, quite optional, so long as we expressed the idea, voicing it without reservation. This was only a beginning. Now, you hear people in meetings, I'm doing the three-step waltz, one, two, three, one, two, three. Step three is not complete until you've done 4 through 12. Step three are the formal terms of surrender that you're going to move forward and do steps 4 through 12. If you have no intention of doing steps 4 through 12, you're not doing the 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3. You're doing nothing, 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 nothing. You're on a diet. That's what you're doing. You're dieting with group support. That's all you're doing. Do they work diets? No, they don't. Very good. Okay. Now it says here, right? Next. It doesn't say in a year. It doesn't say when your therapist or your counselor says to. I used to love it back in the day in Chicago. My counselor says, we don't care what your counselor says. We just care about your recovery. Okay. Next, we launched out on a course of vigorous action, the first step of which is a personal house cleaning, which many of us have never attempted. Though our decision, step three, was a vital and crucial step, it could have little permanent effect unless at once followed by a strenuous effort to face and be rid of the things in ourselves which had been blocking us. Our liquor was but a symptom, so we had to get down to causes and conditions. Food is a symptom. Remember we said that for the compulsive overeater, thank you, Allie, food is not the problem. The problem is the discomfort level that comes about as the result of not eating. That's the problem. The food is the answer to the problem because it gives us that relief. Now, I have a 20-year-old, and she hates me. She doesn't speak to me. She hasn't spoken to me in 2 years. She hates my guts. I have that effect on women. I don't know why. But when she was a little girl, if I had said to her, Hannah, her name's Hannah. That's why I would call her that. Hannah, go clean your room. She would have said things I would never have put on this tape. Oh, my God. I don't know where she learned that. She didn't learn that language from me. I got news for you. My ex-wife was a little bit of a potty mouth, but I don't know where she learned these things. Now, if I would have said to my daughter, Hannah, go in your room, and I want you to take out everything in your room that you want replaced, updated, anything you want a new one of, go in your room and put it in the dumpster, and I'll buy you a brand new one of whatever it is you want to clear out of there. There wouldn't have been anything in that room but two German shepherds looking around like, what the hell happened in here? That's the deal that God is making you. God wants you to have that deal with Him. Go clean out your closet. Go clean your room. And God will replace the things that have been causing your failure. God is going to do for you what I would do for Hannah in that scenario. He is going to replace, update, and modernize anything and everything that you want different that is causing your failure. Let's go back to the book. Page 64. Therefore, we started upon a personal inventory. This was step four. A business which takes no regular inventory usually goes broke. Taking a commercial inventory is a fact-finding and fact-facing process. It is an effort to discover the truth about the stock in trade. One object is to disclose damaged or unsaleable goods to get rid of them promptly and without regret. If the owner of the business is to be successful, he cannot fool himself about values. We did exactly the same thing with our lives. We took stock honestly. First, we searched out the flaws in our makeup which caused our failure. Being convinced that self manifested in various ways was what had defeated us, we considered its common manifestations. Now, before we talk about resentment, let's define what is going on there. The word resentment comes from two old words, re, which always means to do again. Repaint, rewrite, rebuild. It always means to do again. Sentiment comes from an old word, sentire, which means to feel. Resent means to refeel. Now, I happen to love the Chicago Bears. That's my favorite pro football team, is the Chicago Bears. I remember in 1963, as a 9-year-old, before they showed home games on television, I remember listening to the radio when the Bears won the NFL championship against the New York Giants at Wrigley Field. I love the Bears. And I love the Oregon Ducks, too. But I remember well when the Bears won the Super Bowl in January of 1986. And they had the Super Bowl shuffle, and they had the whole thing, and they beat the New England Patriots. Whether the ball was inflated or deflated didn't make a difference. Wouldn't have helped them. Wouldn't have helped them. And I have a CD copy of that broadcast of the Bears from 1986. I used to have a VHS tape, but those have gone the way of the buggy whip. And I could tell you what play was coming. I could tell you what the announcer was going to say. I could tell you the whole thing. Because the CD I have has something that I lack, and that is fidelity. Fidelity, truth, consistency. Because when I replay a resentment in my head, when I replay a resentment in my head, every time I play that resentment, I change it just a little bit. Until you give me enough time to replay that resentment, and I was just standing there doing nothing, and you came along and you did me dirt. You came along and you did me dirt. We're going to take 10 minutes because I got to go potty, and we'll come right back in 10 minutes. It's getting to the wee hours, and I want to try to finish as much as I can so that we don't leave a lot on the table for tomorrow. And my original commitment was to get you out of here about 5. So let's really go through. I'm way behind, and I don't know why. I keep getting sidetracked. 6? What time are we done? Dinner's at 6 or 7? Well, I can't let you out at 6 and have dinner at 6:15. They'll yell at me. They'll scream at me. We're supposed to be done like at 5. I don't want to get hollered at anymore. Somebody in here ratted me out before. Somebody in here ratted me out. It didn't take 15 minutes. Don't tell the people they shouldn't be abstinent. I never said that. I never said that. What I just said was that we're looking for sanity in our relationship with food. Okay, we're going to talk about step 4 now, and what we're going to do is we're going to clean house. And remember that I had a daughter, and when she was little, if I would have said to her, go clean out your room, she'd have said a lot of very terrible words we wouldn't let on here. But if I said to her, Hannah, because that's her name, go clean out your room, and I'll give you anything and everything you want, brand new, up to date, everything brand new and wonderful, there wouldn't have been anything in that room but 2 German shepherds, and they'd be very confused, like, what happened? And that is exactly the deal that God is making you. And remember where this comes from. It comes from a place of Sam Shoemaker, who had a great influence on Bill. And Sam Shoemaker taught Bill Wilson that there are 4 impediments to a spiritual awakening, a spiritual experience, and we've talked about them. Let's talk about them again briefly. What we want is a spiritual awakening as the result of the steps, so that the spiritual awakening will quiet the emotions down so that they will not build up to the level, and when they build up to a certain level, they demand the food. Right? We talked about that this morning. And Sam Shoemaker, he was the Episcopal minister who was the head of the Calvary Mission in New York City for the Oxford Group. He taught Bill, and here's something I bet you didn't know. We'll send you home on this one. Bill asked Sam Shoemaker to write the book, and Sam said, no way. He asked Sam to write the steps. Sam said, no way. But what he did was he had a lot of influence on Bill. And he said to Bill that there's four, he didn't just say it to him, he wrote it in a book 16 years before the big book was written. He says there's four impediments to a spiritual awakening. Four. Number one, a resentment that you will not let go of. We're going to deal with that right now. Number two, a vicarious thrill that you will not let go of. The vicarious thrill isn't reading or bathing or it's backstabbing, gossiping, stealing, lying. That's what we're talking about when we talk about a vicarious thrill. Number three, a restitution that you will not make. Bill didn't think alcoholics are going to make restitution, so he changed that to amends. And number four, a secret that you will not tell. A secret that you will not tell is going to be what? Step five, right? Right? So let's take a look at this resentment section that we've been kind of leading up to, and let's look at it on page 64, at the bottom when it says, resentment is the number one offender. It destroys more alcoholics than anything else. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease. For we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. Now look at that, and what is it telling you? And we've been talking all day about the tapestry of the book, how one thing leads to another, how one idea builds off the other. People that are very resentful do not feel very good, do they? Right? They don't feel very good, right? And what happens when we don't feel good? Our emotions build up and build up and build up, right? They don't build down, they build up. And when those emotions build up, your mental twist wakes up and it says, hey, eat the food. And your intelligence says, no way. And your emotional says, eat the food. And your intelligence says, no way. But every single time the emotions meet up with the intelligent, the emotions will win 100% of the time. It's a battle that the intelligence just cannot win. Can't win, can't beat you. And so these are the things that kill us because they drive us into the food. It's not the resentment that kills you. It's that it drives you into the food. That's the death. There's lots of people out there. This is Los Angeles, baby. This is the second biggest city in America. There's tons of people out there that have resentments. They go to the gym, it's over. They go to, they drink, have a drink, it's over. They yell at the dog, it's over. Sorry, where's the dog? Okay. All right, sorry about that over there. Okay. They yell at the dog, and it's over. Genug. Genug is a Yiddish word for enough. Enough. It's over. Genug. Genug means enough, right? Okay? So this is how it kills you. So that answers the question there that resentment is the number one offender. I used to be able to sit on this chair this morning. I'm getting tired. Okay. From it stem all forms of spiritual disease, for we have not only been mentally and physically ill, we have been spiritually sick. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. Man, you start working this program and you're going to see miracles because this is a promise. You don't have to wait for page 83. When the spiritual malady is overcome, we straighten out mentally and physically. I'm able to do things physically today at age 60 that I couldn't do when I was 17. I'm able to do things today at 60 that I couldn't do ever. Ever. And in many, many ways, I am healthier today at 60 years of age than I have ever been in my life. No more of so many of the things that plague me are these things coming up and biting me in the tuchus. Okay. We asked in dealing with resentments. Okay, column one. Who or what do you resent? In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. Here's your basic instruction. You don't have to buy a concordance. You don't have to buy a pamphlet. You don't have to go out and get this book or that download from the internet. If you have a notebook, can I borrow yours
sure.
for a second? If you have a notebook, just like this, a pencil in Yiddish is a shizzle, in case you're wondering. Okay. So, this is a notebook. You take a notebook, you make four columns. You can all count to four, right? This is not such tough stuff, but we make it so, oh my God, the fourth step. And some of that is the fellowship. Some of that is us. Oh, when you get to your fourth step, man, are you in trouble? It's easy. You know who you resent, right? Right? You know who you resent? Okay, you know why you resent them? You got the first two columns done. You know what part of self is affected? We talked about sex instinct. We talked about social instinct and the security instinct. So you may need a little help there, especially just getting started. And then the fourth column is going to be real easy. It's what did you do, your part in things. That'll be a little trickier, and that's why you need a good sponsor. But let's just do the first couple of columns right now. Let's do the first three. First column, who or what do you resent? It's not always a who. I had a resentment for years against the expression, blood is thicker than water. Why? Anytime somebody said, blood is thicker than water, I was left out of the conversation. I wake up at my own family reunion every day. I don't have brothers and sisters, aunts, uncles, or cousins. I don't have parents and grandparents. So anytime somebody said, blood is thicker than water, it made me mad. I didn't like that, so I put it down. Now I'm okay with it. I have what I have. It is what it is. It's good. It's all good. It's all good. Second column, what did they do to you? Don't write a book, 19 words or less. Don't write a flipping book, what did they? He did this, and then he did that. If you need more than one, and you probably will need more than one resentment against your mother, your father, your whatever, use them individually, but 19 words or less, please. I don't want to sit at the coffee plantation with you all day. Please. Have some Rachmanis on somebody here, please. Rachmanis is mercy, okay? Third column, what part of self is affected? Basic instincts. What part of self is affected? Anybody not know who they're mad at? If you don't know you're mad at them, don't put them down. It's okay. Anybody not know what they did to you? You all know that, right? Now, before we get to the fourth column, well, I'll save that for when we get there. Let's go back to the basic instruction here. Bottom of 64. In dealing with resentments, we set them on paper. We listed people, institutions, or principles with whom we were angry. We asked ourselves why we were angry. First two columns are done, right? This is real simple. We're going to bust through the myth. Excuse me. In most cases, it was found that our self-esteem, our pocketbooks, our ambitions, our personal relationships, including sex, were hurt or threatened. So we were sore. We were burned up. On our grudge list, we set opposite each name our injuries. What is it? Was it our self-esteem, our security, our ambitions, our personal or sex relations, which had been interfered with? We were usually as definite as this example. We're only going to take Mr. Brown because of time. Mr. Brown, I'm mad at Mr. Brown. Why? His attention to my wife. What the hell? Oh, and that's going to affect my sex relations, self-esteem, fear. Let's blow that up just a little bit. Mr. Brown is paying attention to my wife. And that's exactly what did happen to me in my marriage. My wife went to work at a real estate company. And she fell in love with somebody through there, and that was now I'm divorced. So I lived that firsthand. Well, when you have that kind of situation, what is the fear? It's not just the simple fear of losing your wife. Let's expand that into real life. Somebody's paying attention to my wife. She's going to take half my money. What are my friends going to think? What are her relatives going to think? What's my boss going to think? And on and on and on. So it isn't just as simple as Mr. Brown is paying attention to my wife. It gets a little deeper than that when you look at the self-esteem, the fear, and these various issues. Okay? So that's why they have the fear bracketed. It's not the fear inventory, but it's the character defect of fear as it manifests in the resentment inventory. If you have a good save it for the end, write it down. If you have a good sponsor and you can walk through that It's really very simple. It's very, very simple, okay? So let's do another one. Let's expand on Mr. Brown here, okay? What's the next one? He told my wife of my mistress. Hey, wait a minute. He's worried about Brown paying attention to his wife, and Mr. Lucky Zipper over there's got a mistress. So what the hell? Wait a minute. We've got a little thing going on there. What's good for the goose ain't good for the gander, I guess. Okay? So we've got that going on. Tells my wife of my mistress, that's going to affect my sex relations. If my wife finds out I got a little hottie on the side, she's probably not going to be too interested in giving it up tonight, right? And then I've got fear, and I've got self-esteem. What am I going to think of myself if they find out I've got a mistress? What's the fear here? What are my friends going to think when I have a mistress? What are her family members, her friends, going to think when I have a mistress? What am I going to think of myself? And we talked about self-esteem just a little bit before the break. And what I think of me is not usually what I think of me. It's what I think you think of me. And if I think you think I'm a pretty good guy, then I'm going to like me. But if I think you think that I'm a jerk, then I'm not going to like me so much. So these are the things that we're talking about. Any type of problem we have with what we currently have in these basic instincts or our ambitions for the future in these areas are going to trigger this very easily. That is where resentment comes from. We've talked about that. That's where fear comes from. Fear and resentment don't just fall through the air and land on some people but not others. We all have these basic instincts. They're hardwired, and they're given to us by a loving God. It's what happens, what we do with them, that can make us or break us. Okay, let's take a look, not at the next example, because we haven't the time. Let's go to the very bottom of 65. We went back through our lives. Nothing counted but thoroughness and honesty. There's nothing in there about perfection. One of the biggest problems we have in the fellowship of OA today is you've got people waiting to be the perfect weight, work the perfect food plan, have the perfect sponsor, have the perfect life before they do the perfect fourth step. Let me assure you, God is not going to put your fourth step on his refrigerator. Just do the damn thing. That's why we have step 10, is nothing, don't deliberately leave things off, but for crying out loud, stop dragging it out and get the damn thing done. We have another step 10 where if something does get by you, God Almighty, it's going to be okay. We don't have OA police. Did you forget to put Mrs. Redmond down, your third grade teacher, for not making you a hall monitor? Come with us. We don't have that. We don't have that. Stop trying to do it perfectly and do it. And I'll give you some words that you may find beneficial. Parents, write these words down. When you're looking for your resentments, parents, family members, friends, schoolmates, teachers, church or synagogue, camp, activities, neighborhood, college, high school, jobs, spouse. Let these words jar your memory. Things will come to you. Things will come to you. And if they don't, they don't. I can't remember the lady who pissed me off, but she was wearing a red dress. Put down the lady with the red dress. What are we talking about here? You're going to go investigate people wearing red dresses in September of 1963. What are we talking? Put down the lady with the red dress and move on with your life. Move on. Get it done. Let's go back to the step here. So I'm hoping that this most misunderstood step is clearing up a little bit, that this is not that difficult. It really, really isn't. The first thing apparent was that this world, top of 66, and its people were often quite wrong. Boy, there's one of the understatements of the year, that the people were wrong, right? To conclude that others were wrong was as far as most of us ever got. The usual outcome was that people continued to wrong us and we stayed sore. Sometimes it was remorse and then we were sore at ourselves. But the more we fought and tried to have our own way, the worse matters got. We were really flies in the spider web, weren't we? As in war, the victor only seemed to win. Our moments of triumph were short-lived. It is plain that a life which includes deep resentment leads only to futility and unhappiness. There's a warning. To the precise extent that we permit these, do we squander the hours that might have been worthwhile? But with the alcoholic whose hope is the maintenance and growth of a spiritual experience, this business of resentment is infinitely grave. We found that it is fatal. The way that the resentment will kill you is it will keep raising your emotional level to the point where your mental twist will force you into the food. You will eat the food. You will trigger the physical allergy. You will pass through the well-known stages of a spree, emerging remorseful with a firm resolution not to eat that way again. And you will repeat that cycle over and over and over and over and over and over again, the mind telling you that the food makes perfect sense and the body ensuring it indeed does not. Okay? For when harboring such feelings, to harbor means to give safe haven to these feelings, we shut ourselves off from the sunlight of the spirit. The insanity of alcohol returns and we drink again. With us to drink is to die. If we were going to live, we had to be free of anger. The grouch and the brainstorm were not for us. The grouch is the person that is angry all the time. The brainstorm is the person who has fits of anger and fits of not anger. The brainstorm is very volatile and the grouch is pissed off all the time. And we all know those people. And if you're one of them, people that are that way don't feel very good, do they? And if you don't feel very good, your emotional level will build. You'll eat. You know the whole thing by now. These may be the dubious luxury of normal men, but for alcoholics, these things are poison. We turned back to the list, for it held the key to the future. We were prepared to look at it from an entirely different angle. We began to see that the world and its people really dominated us. In that state, the wrongdoing of others, fancied or real, had power to actually kill. How could we escape? We saw that these resentments must be mastered, but how? We could not wish them away any more than alcohol. This was our course. We realized that the people who wronged us were perhaps spiritually sick. Though we did not like their symptoms and the way these disturbed us, they, like ourselves, were sick too. Excuse me. We ask God to help us show them the same tolerance, pity, and patience that we would cheerfully grant a sick friend. When a person offended, we said to ourselves, "This is a sick man. How can I be helpful to him? God, save me from being angry. Thy will be done." That's your sick man prayer. That's your fourth step prayer. That's your prayer. We avoid retaliation or argument. We wouldn't treat sick people that way. If we do, we destroy our chance of being helpful. We cannot be helpful to all people, but at least God will show us how to take a kindly and tolerant view of each and every one. Now, before we read the fourth column, which is your part in this, you're going to list your behaviors and you're going to list the character defects that cause you to take or omit those actions. But before I get to this sentences, I want to bring something out that a lot of people avoid. There are people in this room that have had horrific wrongs done to them that they had no part in. Statistically speaking, there are people in this room that have been molested by their parents. Statistically speaking, there are people in this room that have been raped. Statistically speaking, there are people in this room that have been abandoned by the very people who were assigned to watch over them and protect them, and those people failed in their tasks miserably. You have suffered tremendous pain in your life, and you have no part. And on behalf of the human race, I am sorry. Truly sorry. I am sorry that these things happened to you. And you may be saying to yourself, I had no part in this and I had no part in that. I know a little bit about that too. I grew up at the feet of a man who had had some injustices done to him. And he was the sole survivor in a family of 40 people. And he was the only one who lived. You've never seen your father cry. I've seen my father cry hundreds of times. Hundreds of times. There are injustices in this world, and there is pain in this world, that it is a testimony to a loving, powerful God that we as humans can withstand the pain. The mind and body are marvelous mechanisms. Remember, we read that this morning. And you may say to yourself, I had no part in that. That's okay. Put it down. List it down. When it comes to the fourth column, what did you do to set the ball in motion? Right, DNA does not apply. Does not apply. But we're going to ask God to carry that luggage from now on because we can't do it anymore and not eat. Those people that came to my father's house that day to kill them, they not getting me. No way. I don't die in the food and give them one more victim. Not me, baby. I'm going to live and I'm going to leave retribution to God. We have choices. We are not responsible. I used to go to meetings with somebody in Chicago named Shirley. Shirley S. Her daughter fell in love with Mr. Wrong. And one day he came to her house and blew her brains out. And she lived with that. And about 2 months, it was headline news in every newspaper in Chicago. I don't know, anywhere else. She came back to meetings and she was the same color as this roof. This ceiling here. That's the color that she was. She said something very profound. This is about a year in. He took my daughter. He's not getting me. Now, if she can rise above the injustice of what happened to her, and others can too, I have to think that that same bridge that will enjoy it will link you to the peace you seek is there in God's world. Trust God. Test God. Find Him wanting. I challenge you, you cannot do it. And if you keep working these steps and you keep evolving in your spiritual life, you will find a peace and freedom so that maybe one day you can advocate back against the things that happened in yours, in your life. A lot of times when these things happen, one of two things will happen, and this is not part of our work in OA, but it's just knowledge. You either become another perpetrator or you advocate back against it. You're not fighting anyone. You're fighting for your life by holding God's hand peacefully. Now we're going to look at the fourth column. What's your part in things? And when you look at this column and you start to write this column, your entire perspective of this resentment is going to change. I love sitting down with people to do a fifth step because most of them are giddy. They're giddy. They're elated. They're happy. Why are they happy? Because they've just seen the patterns of their insanity. Cool ringer. They've just seen the patterns of their craziness and they're laughing, not at me, I hope. They're laughing at themselves because they see the selfishness, the self-seeking, the dishonesty, the fear, the this, the that. They see it. And when you see it, you're so far down the way of letting God have it. You're right knocking on the door of 6 and 7. It's a beautiful experience. It's beautiful. Let's go back to the fourth column, and we're going to be pushed for time here, and I don't want to get hollered at because one of you guys ratted me out, and I'm going to find out. Talk about resentment. Boy, I better work on my steps here, right? 67, referring to our list again, putting out of our minds the wrongs others had done, we resolutely looked for our own mistakes. Oh boy, I've never done that before. Where had we been selfish, dishonest, self-seeking, and frightened? Though a situation had not been entirely our fault, we tried to disregard the other person involved entirely. Where were we to blame? The inventory was ours, not the other man's. When we saw our faults, we listed them. Excuse me. We placed them before us in black and white. That's your instruction. Couldn't be any easier. Here's what you did, or here's what you omitted doing. Put it down, and then put down the character defects that caused you to take or omit the action. Tell me the truth here. Is that so complicated that you can't do it? Is that so tough? But yet we make this whole Megillah, this whole thing about the four step. There's a little bookstore where I go to meetings. They make a fortune in there selling the pamphlets and concordances and these downloads and this and that. My God, why didn't I think it? No. By God in heaven, you don't need it. You need one of these. This and a shizzle. What's a shizzle? It's a pencil. Very good. That's a pencil in Yiddish. It's a shizzle. Shizzle. And all you need is this. Everybody's got this. You don't need one. You don't have one. They're like $1 or $2, whatever, at the store. Okay? It's not that complicated. Okay, let's finish this and go on to the fear and the sex, and we'll be done. Okay. When we saw our faults, we listed them. We placed them before us in black and white. We admitted our wrongs honestly, and we're willing to set these matters straight. Those are your basic instructions for the resentment section. No big deal. Let's do the fear and the sex, and we're done. Okay. Oh, for the sex part, I'll need a volunteer up here. Okay. Notice that the word fear is bracketed alongside the difficulties with Mr. Brown, Mrs. Jones, the employer, and the wife. This short word somehow touches about every aspect of our lives. It was an evil and corroding thread. The fabric of our existence was shot through with it. It set in motion trains of circumstances which brought us misfortune. Brought us misfortune we felt we didn't deserve. But did not we ourselves set the ball rolling? Sometimes we think fear ought to be classed with stealing. It seems to cause more trouble. Now let's do the fear inventory. Same four columns. Who or what do you fear? Why do you fear it? What basic instinct is affected? What's your part? What character defects cause you to take or omit the action? Simple. Four columns for resentment, four columns for fear, five columns and a separate assignment for sex. Simple. 4, 4, 5 with a separate assignment in sex with the sexual ideal. Let's get to it. We reviewed our fears thoroughly. We put them on paper. Column 1, who or what do you fear? Simple. Even though we had no resentment in connection with them. So if you have a resentment in connection with the fear, where does it go? Resentment. Right, say it loud.
The resentment section.
See, you hear it. Okay, very good. We asked ourselves why we had them. Why do you have the fear? Is this complicated? Okay. Wasn't it because self-reliance failed us? Self-reliance was good as far as it went, but it didn't go far enough. Some of us once had great self-confidence, but it didn't fully solve the fear problem or any other. When it made us cocky, it was worse. Perhaps there's a better way. We think so, for we are now on a different basis, the basis of trusting and relying upon God. We trust infinite God rather than our finite selves. We are in the world to play the role he assigns, just to the extent that we do as we think he would, as we think he would have us and humbly rely on him. Does he enable us to match calamity with serenity? What a beautiful promise. Calamity with serenity. Column 1 in the fear column, fear's inventory. Who or what do you fear? Column 2, why do you fear it? 19 words or less, please. We've got lives too as sponsors. 19 words or less. Okay. Column 3, what basic instinct is affected by this fear? And column 4, what did you do to bring this fear about, and what defects of character were brought into play by your action or omission of action? Column 4, what did you do to bring this fear about or not do to bring this fear about? For example, I fear the IRS. Why? They're going to throw me in jail. What part of self is affected? Security, sex, and social. Column 4, I didn't pay my taxes. Why didn't I pay my taxes? Dishonesty, selfishness, self-seeking. Those are the defects that caused me not to pay my taxes. Next. It's not complicated. Next fear. Right? Anybody not get that? Honestly. Good. Oh, what?
Oh,
there's one in every crowd. Okay.
I'm confused that I can't stand Jack Smith because he's...
Me neither. You schmuck.
Because he stole money from me.
Stole money from me.
Okay.
That's a resentment. That's not a fear.
I'll
explain it then. You've got four columns in your resentment section.
I know, but I'm...
Tatala will go over.
Tell me later.
Okay, I'll tell you later then. For the purpose of time, I'll indulge you in that one, or I would address it now. Okay. We never apologize to anyone for depending upon our Creator. We can laugh at those who think spirituality the way of weakness. Paradoxically, it is the way of strength. They, isn't there? The verdict of the ages is that faith means courage. All men of faith have courage. They trust their God. We never apologize for God. Instead, we let Him demonstrate through us what He can do. We ask Him to remove our fear and direct our attention to what He would have us be at once we commence to outgrow fear. Now about sex. God, we don't have time for this. But anyway, what are some of the things that we do to hurt each other, harm each other, in the sexual area? This is one of the areas where we can really cut very deeply into another person. And let's look at sex, and I'm going to give you my opinion here, and this is not OA's opinion, this is not AA's opinion, it's my opinion, okay? God gave us the sex instinct so that we could enjoy sex. Whether it's man-man, woman-woman, man-woman, no difference whatsoever. If it's two consenting adults and nobody's taking advantage of anybody, great. He gave us this instinct so that we could enjoy it. He also gave us this instinct so that we could reproduce ourselves. Because if we didn't have this instinct so deeply ingrained in us, we wouldn't do the work necessary to propagate the human race. But some of the ways that we use sex for something other than what it was intended for can be very detrimental. For instance, now the most obvious one is cheating. That's the one everybody goes points to first. Now I'm going to talk about me. I'm not going to talk about you. What you do is okay. I cannot be working the 12 steps while I'm breaking the 10 commandments. I can't do it because it's incongruent. It's not honest. And somebody very, very smart said to me years ago, if everything you did today, everywhere you went today, everything you said and everything you ate was on the front page of the Chicago Tribune, are you okay with that? Because if you're not, you're engaging in behaviors you want kept secret unto you, and that is the illness in its active form. Where I go and what I do is something I am more than willing to discuss with my sponsor and other trusted OA friends. Now, let's take a look at how we use sex for something other than what it was intended for. Let's say we are using sex to get even with another person. You're having a fight with your girlfriend. You're a female. And as a way of getting her back, you're going to seduce Larry because you know that she loves Larry, so you seduce Larry to hurt her. Enjoyment has nothing to do with that. Recreation has nothing to do with that. That's using your God-given sex prowess for something other than what it was intended for. Let's just say, for example, you are in a committed relationship and you are making demands on your partner that your partner has voiced to you on numerous occasions that they are uncomfortable with. And you keep making these demands upon them and making them. That is a form of sexual harm too. Maybe you're in a committed relationship and you need to give in a little bit more. Maybe you need to do something that the other person has asked you many times to do to give them a little pleasure too. That's a form of sexual harm as well. What we also have is using our God-given sex powers where it has nothing to do with sex, with enjoyment or recreation, to maybe manipulate another person. Let me give you an example. You know very well that one of your supervisors at the office has a crush on you. So you flirt back with them. You lead them on. You make them think that they have some sort of chance to date you when in reality you know very well that they indeed do not have that chance. But you lead them on because you don't want them to fire you. You don't want them to cut your pay. You don't want to be on the chopping block when layoffs are announced. And so you do that. Sex, enjoyment has nothing to do with that. Recreation has nothing to do with that. Perhaps you're withholding sex. You're withholding affection because they're Democrats and you want them to be Republicans, or they're Republicans and you want them to be Democrats. Whatever that may be, you are withholding affection. You are withholding sex. You are withholding yourself till that other person comes around to your way of thinking. These are some, but not all, of the ways that we can harm one another in this arena. So with that in mind, and maybe you have some others that maybe I didn't mention, that's possible too. So let's take a look very quickly at the sex inventory at the very bottom of 68. Okay, now about sex. Many of us needed an overhauling there, but above all, we tried to be sensible on this question. It's so easy to get way off the track. Here we find human opinions running to extremes, absurd extremes perhaps. One set of voices cry that sex is a lust of our lower nature, a base necessity of procreation. And then we have the voices who cry for sex and more sex, who bewail the institution of marriage, who think that most of the troubles of the race are traceable to sex causes. They think we do not have enough of it, or it isn't the right kind. They see its significance everywhere. One school would allow man no flavor for his fare, and the other would have us on a straight pepper diet. We want to stay out of this controversy. We do not want to be the arbiter of anyone's sex conduct. We all have sex problems. We'd hardly be human if we didn't. What can we do about them? Five columns for the sex inventory with a side assignment. Column one, who did you hurt? This will always be a who. Unless you're having sex with woodchucks or trees or something, this will always be a who. Column two, what'd you do to them? 19 words or less, please. Please. Okay, column three, what part of self is affected? Column four, what character defect, or excuse me, column, yeah, I did one, two, three is what did I do to them? Four is the basic instinct. Five is the defect of character that caused you to take or omit the action from column two. Column one, who did you hurt? Column two, what did you do to them? Column three, what basic instinct is affected? Column four, what defect or defects of character caused you to take or omit the hurtful thing in column two? So we've separated the action from the defect and made another column. And then column five, what should you have done instead? Four is, what defects of character cause you to take or omit the actions that hurt that person? We have a side assignment here of a sexual ideal. Now, what does that mean? I want a brunette, and this is what I want. No, that's not what we're talking about here. What we're talking about here is, what are you going to do to bring a better you into the relationship you're in, or one in the future? I learned a lot from my marriage about me. I was married to the first girl that I ever didn't run away. She wasn't running away from me, and she wanted to get married, so hey, I married her. I don't think I'd do that again. And very, very, very early on in my marriage, in the relationship before it became a marriage, I abdicated my adult status and became the child. I abdicated and allowed her to make all the decisions, thinking I was doing it for her, but what I was really doing was for me, because if I had to take responsibility for those decisions, I wasn't really willing to do that. So if she made all the decisions, I couldn't be blamed for anything, and I didn't have to be an adult in the relationship. Very, very quickly on in that relationship, I became the child and she became the parent. I will never do that again. If I'm ever lucky enough to get into another relationship, I'm going to step up to the plate and be an adult. And I'm going to have opinions. That doesn't mean that I'm going to get my way. It just means I'm going to be an adult. I'm not going to be the child. I'm not going to be the little baby. And I realize now that my situation was reminiscent of my entire life. It was just patterns repeated over and over and over again, and they manifested in my marriage. And there are things that you don't do to your mother. And most of my marriage was platonic. I was married 17 and a half years. I had very, very little in the way of sexual encounters with this woman over 17 and a half years, and nothing for about the last 9 or 10 years, nothing. I would never allow that again. I would say we either need counseling or we need to call it a day, because that's just not something I'm going to ever be in again. If I'm lucky enough to get in a relationship, and I'm not saying it's got to be the last days of Caligula, but at least... You know, every once in a while, you better be glad I'm home from the North Scottsdale Fellowship Club, you know, or we're doing something real wrong here. And I learned that these are the things that weighed on my marriage tremendously, was my inability to accept adulthood, my reluctance to be a person that I knew I was. And I had opinions and I had solutions, but I let her do everything because she's the greatest and I don't want her to get pissed off. Well, look at me now. I've been divorced for 5 years. So how well is that working for you? Not too well. So these are the things I learned. These are the things that I saw in myself as I did these inventories during the marriage and then after the marriage, in the aftermath of the marriage. Doing this kind of work really just revealed these things to me. They were just right there. They were right there. And I saw some glaring signs, danger, that this marriage was not supposed to happen. And I said nothing because I was scared to death that if I let her go, I'd never find anyone else. I went on my first date. I was 35 years old. Where was I going to... The only other girl I was ever involved with broke up with me. I had no idea that breaking up and getting to... And all, I had no idea that this was something all 13, 14-year-olds go through. And even though I was 36, 37, whatever it was, in relationships, I was 12, I was 14. They don't marry the first person that comes along when you're in sophomore year high school. They just, some do. I mean, you know, there are people that do, but very, very few of them. Well, I didn't understand that. And so I took these glaring warning signs and I just ignored them. And I said, oh, nothing the matter over here. Ain't it grand? The wind stopped blowing. And there was a lot wrong. There was a lot wrong. As it turned out, we have a beautiful daughter. She doesn't speak to me. She hates me, but she's beautiful. And she's wonderful. And she would never have come about if we didn't get married. So, okay, all things, you know, work out in God's world. So these are the things. And that's the sexual ideal that we're going to write on when it gives you that assignment. Okay? That's the sexual ideal. Column 1 in the sex inventory, who did you hurt? Column 2, what did you do to them or omit doing? Column 3, what basic part of self is affected. Column 4, what defects of character cause you to take or omit the actions from column 2? And column 5, what should you have done instead? Okay, we got these all down on paper, and we looked at it. And I bet you there's nobody in here that can't do that. These are simple things. If you need the help, that's what sponsors are for. That's what sponsors are for. That's what we're here for. We're here to help you. We're here to answer your questions, okay? Let's go to page... Whatever our ideal turns out to be, we must be willing to grow toward it. We must be willing to make amends where we have done harm, provided that we do not bring about still more harm in so doing. In other words, we treat sex as we would any other problem. In meditation, we ask God what we should do about each specific matter. The right answer will come if we want it. If you want to continue harming people and you're just into, you know, getting your rocks off, then nothing's going to happen. God alone can judge our sex situation. Counsel with, there we go, other persons is often desirable, but we let God be the final judge. We realize that some people are as fanatical about sex as others are loose. We avoid hysterical thinking or advice. Suppose we fall short of the chosen ideal and stumble. Does this mean we are going to get drunk? Some people tell us so, but this is only a half-truth. It depends on us and our motives. If we are sorry for what we have done and have the honest desire to let God take us to better things, we believe we will be forgiven and will have learned our lesson. If we're not sorry and our conduct continues to harm others, we are quite sure to drink. We are not theorizing. These are facts out of our experience. To sum up about sex, we earnestly pray for the right ideal, for guidance in each questionable situation, for sanity and the strength to do the right thing. If sex is very troublesome, we throw ourselves the harder into helping others. We think of their needs and work for them. This takes us out of ourselves. It quiets the imperious urge when to yield would mean heartache. If we have been thorough about our personal inventory, we have written down a lot. We have listed and analyzed our resentments. We have begun to comprehend their futility and their fatality. We have commenced to see their terrible destructiveness. We have begun to learn tolerance, patience, and goodwill toward all men, even our enemies, for we look on them as sick people. We have listed the people we have hurt by our conduct and are willing to straighten out the past if we can. You have no right to go make amends to anybody. Let's say you were kissing Mary's husband. You have no right to knock on the door and say, Mary, I've been kissing your husband. You know how you make amends to Mary? You stop kissing her husband. You do not knock on the door and say, I'm sorry, I was kissing. You don't have the right to do that. In this book, you will read again and again that faith did for us what we could not do for ourselves. We hope you are convinced now that God can remove whatever self-will has blocked you off from him. If you have already made a decision, step 3, excuse me, and an inventory of your grosser handicaps, step 4, you have already made a good beginning. How many times I've sat there, listened to fifth steps, and never saw the person again as long as I lived. This is a beginning. This is a beginning. This is not the end zone. This is not the end zone here. That brings, so you have swallowed and digested some big chunks of truth about yourself. Now, I'm supposed to read this to you before I let you go, and before I let you go, I will read this. Please announce at the end, we need your badge holders. If you are leaving, please drop them off at the front desk. Thanks. Okay. More tomorrow when we'll do 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, 11, and 12. More tomorrow. Thank you.